A little bit about Rav Amital and Parsha Shlach. Each of these ideas are very characteristic and central to Rav Amital's thought, his personality, I think his legacy. So I don't want you to feel that the first is just peripheral, because the second is major, the second is famous. But the first is also pretty important, but it's a little more subtle. But it's more relevant to Parsha Shlach, so I figured we'd start with Shlach. But why don't we close the windows, if we have the air conditioning on, when we get it nice and cold in here. Okay, so Parsha Shlach presents a lot of riddles, a lot of confusion. And Rav Amital tabled three of them. It wasn't really his style. That wasn't his style to speak and say, this question, I'll solve them all. But in this case, he did. Number one. Who initiated it? Parsha Shlach, it sounds like Moshe Rabbeinu initiates the process. Shlach lecha nashim. Yisur Tzeres Kenan. Hashem tells Moshe, Moshe initiates. Basically, it's Moshe HaKadosh Baruch Hu launching the process. Parshas Devarim, Vatikuvon Elai. Look at your sources. Source 2. Vatikuvon Elai Kulchem Vatomer, Nish lecha nashim lefaneinu. V'yachbur lanu osaretz, v'yashivu lansanu davar. So in Parshas Veschanan, it sounds like Moshe HaKadosh Baruch Hu just responding to the people's initiative. So question number one, who launches the process? This ill-fated, tragic conclusion, but who starts the process? Number two, Moshe, according to Chazal, is somewhat aware of the potential deterioration of this journey. He beckons Yehoshua for a private meeting, the Gemara tells us in Sota, source number Gimel, Yehoshua kvar bikesh Moshe alev rachamim. Moshe already is davening for Yehoshua. He makes a mishaberach for Yehoshua. Because he worries that Yehoshua will fall prey to the scheming and the conspiracies of the Meraglim. So Moshe is quite aware of these rebellious tendencies. So if he's aware, why doesn't he scuttle the whole project? If you're Moshe, you're aware that it could go south, pull the plug. Kill it in the courts. Put in some file cabinet for a later date. Why is he dispatching them knowing that they're going to fail, davening for Yehoshua? Isn't he complicit in this great failure? Question number three. This is Moshe's debut. This is when he davens the Yud Gimel Midot. So we talked a little bit about Yud Gimel Midot Terachamim in Elul. Hashem told Moshe during the Chet HaEgel, you've davened on behalf of Am Yisrael because of what the Egyptians would say, Lama Yamur HaMitzrim, Bira HaTziyam, Lama Yamur Paro. You daven based on Zechut Avot, but some of those will expire. I have to teach you how to daven in a more sustainable fashion. So in Parshat Ki Tisa, Hashem teaches Moshe, Yud Gimel Midot. Hashem, Kel Rechum Echanon, Erech Apayim, Rav Chesed, Biamet. And this is where Moshe first employs that tefillah. Moshe says, Yigdal Na Koach Hashem Kasher Dibarta. You taught me this davening, now I'm following your instructions. So, absolve Am Yisrael, forgive Am Yisrael. And Hashem says, you're right, Salachti Kidvarecha. I listened to you, I taught you this davening, now I'm going to comply with my original instructions. So Hashem says, source number four, Slachna, Moshe says, Slachna, Lavon HaMazek HaGodol Chastecha, V'chasher Nasasa LaMazem Mitzayim V'nheina, Yom Hashem, Salachti Kidvarecha. Anyone know when we recite these psukim? They form the cornerstone of a very important tefillah, the climax. It's also the cornerstone. Shlichos, yes, but also Kol Nidre. We start Kol Nidre. Salachti Kid Varecha. V'yam Hashem Salachti Kid Varecha. V'yam Hashem Salachti Kid Varecha. This is very important tefillah. So everything's set. Moshe was instructed. Moshe davens. Hashem forgives. And what's the next pasuk? V'ulam chay ani no Hashem. V'mali chavod Hashem is kol aretz. These people won't enter the land. Wait a second. Didn't you just forgive them? Didn't you just say Salachti Kid Varecha? The next pasuk should read, I'm the Av HaRachamon, and even though they've sinned, I will send my Malach with them. It should be Parshas Ki Tisa. Why does Hashem forgive them and then banishes them or bans them from Israel? Three questions. Who initiates? Question number two. If Moshe has foreknowledge of this potential hazard, why does he allow it? Why does he allow this baby to be born? And three, why does Hashem forgive them and then ban them? So the answer is as following. I prominent way to understand. Not the only, but a prominent and popular way to understand the Miraglim episode is that the Jewish people were clamoring for a different type of experience. They had lived the supernatural 2 years in the desert. Splitting seas, man from heaven, Pharaoh being decimated by 10 plagues, Moshe ascending fiery mountains. They went through all that. Now they're craving normal day-to-day citizenship. As they're about to enter Israel, remember, you have to be able to read Shlach in the right context. And you can't because you were born into the wrong context. You're reading it as part of living in the Upper West Side or living in Teaneck. We are 11 days away from Utopia. The original plan was to enter the land. It takes 11 days to walk from Har Sinai to Israel. Some say 3, but let's just say 11. Err on the safe side. Not more. 11 days away from entering the land, so they'll get there. Again, it's the second year, so the Egel somewhat detoured it. So they'll get there somewhere in the summer of the second year. They could have gotten there the first year. Enter the land around now. It's June 15th today. Nice round figure. It takes about 6 weeks to empty the land of paganists, to conquer the land, build a Beis HaMikdash by Rosh Hashanah time, history ends. Nice and clean, nice and neat. Utopia, Messianic era, end of history. Everything you've lived is a mirage. Nothing was meant to happen. It feels real, it's a mirage. It's a detour. Not Teaneck, not the West Side, not Poland, not Russia, not Spain, not Constantinople, not Baghdad, not Borough Park, nothing. The challenge of being an Oved Hashem is you have to live with schizophrenia. You have to be able to embrace your reality and try to change it and live within it. You can't be escapist. But you can never become too comfortable. A good parting message. And just accept them as the perfect and ultimate terms of human condition or of Jewish experience. They're not. There's a part of you that has to be left here in this hillside and in this country and realize that we're still clamoring for more, and as perfect as your life may or may not be, but as Hashem, until we have that utopian era and Mashiach comes, it's all going to just be a detour. So this entry into Eretz Yisrael is not just a geographic relocation as if they're making Aliyah. This is now a major shift. And they're looking to shift from supernatural experience into natural experience. They just want to be normal. When you're young, it's hard to identify that. As you get older, you'll start to feel it. Even now, you can try. When's the last time you had so much action in your life for a certain period? Tests and NCSY regionals or Ben Akiva and camp and bar mitzvahs and a gift and a that and a run. So I just want to get back to normal. I just want to go back, be in my bed, go to school, take my courses, get up in the morning in the same bed twice in a row, same time. When you're young, it's harder to sense that because life is still very erratic. It's not as continuous. But once you get a routine, you realize the power of a routine, and you want to maintain that routine. So they just want to feel. Shouldn't be man from heaven, splitting sea, spire from heaven. Just be normal life. And that's why they want to send Miraglim. They want to send Miraglim because this is a show as well as a generator. We're normal. We don't just walk into a land unannounced and conquer it. We know that. We know Hashem can do that. We want to send spies, reconnaissance mission, intel. Who are the strong people? Who are the weak people? Points of access, types of fruit. How armed are our opponents? This is not a lack of faith. These were princes. These were leaders. These were people who said, let's transition into normalcy rather than supernatural. Not that there's anything wrong with supernatural, but it's not sustainable. It's highs. It's very erratic. And let's just reach that stage where we're normal people. Here's the catch. Really important, really subtle. It's fundamental to Rav Amital's thought. I was in Baltimore 2 weeks ago. I spoke about it late at night, like 11:30-ish. That's how central it is. They weren't yet ready for that ideal. They were not yet prepared. They were still premature. They still needed to see HaKadosh Baruch Hu more blatantly, overtly. They needed that search. They were slaves for too long, and they needed a corrective. And essentially now Moshe is faced with a competition or a duel of two different ideals, two different templates. Not good and bad, just
imperfect but elusive and not compatible with your current state, namely normal, routine, natural experience, because they're not there yet. They're not ready to just lock into these normal citizenship. And the supernatural level that they didn't want, but was more fitting for where they were right now, for their current stage. So Moshe can't deny their interest in becoming a normal people, because that's legitimate, that's valid. But he knows they're not ready yet. So he can't deny their request. He has to accede to it because it's legitimate. But he knows this is going to essentially fail. He davens for Yehoshua. And here's the thesis before we get to the elaboration. Hashem forgives the Jewish people because of Moshe davens, and Hashem's a forgiving king. But he doesn't take him into the land, not because of a punishment, just not ready. They're not ready for that transition. They have to live life in the desert 40 more years in some supernatural reality to reach the stage that they're ready to assume that natural reality. He doesn't punish them. He forgives them, but they're just not ready yet. Yes, does.
So with this explanation, it makes sense why, like, they lie and they wanted to send Nagu for themselves. And why would Hashem want to send Nagu? Like, if...
No, Moshe, they initiated in Parshas Devarim.
Yeah.
And then Parshas Shlach is recording that HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Moshe through HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows it, because it's a legitimate request, it can't be denied, but it's not yet the idea.
Oh, so like the more accurate story is Devarim?
Right. The accurate story, Devarim is A and Shlach is B. Now why the Torah provides B before A, that's a separate story. Okay. That's a separate question, that's more of a biblical analysis. Why is A more appropriate for the setting of Devarim and B is more appropriate for the setting of Amidbar? But that's based on larger literary concerns. So now you have a very interesting way of thinking about Am Yisrael, about your personal life. And I'm not sure if you've ever thought this way. Are there ideals in life that are just not yet acquirable or attainable or appropriate for where you are? We tend to be very binary. If it's an ideal, then we should be there. Are there things that we're trying to achieve and aspiring to in life, but it's legitimate not to achieve them in the immediate, and sometimes it's even inappropriate to strive for them in the immediate because they don't reflect where we are as a person, as a people? Right. But when you reach that moment, you feel like you're a failure. Because when you gauge the gap between your ideals and your accomplishment, and the gap is too large, you say, wait a second, I'm a failure. I hope you say you're a failure. Part of the problem is my DNA has eliminated guilt and failure, so you never say you're a failure because you never fail, because we built a world in which we never fail. But ideally, a person who lives a healthy religious life should encounter failure. These are my goals, or these are the ideals that I've been taught. This is my current program or experience or level, and there's a gap. So that means I failed to overlap the two and sync the two, and I'm a failure. Or you say it's a process, and there are legitimate gains that are quantifiable and valid for the meantime, and we're not yet at the stage where you can expect of yourself or of ourselves as a people, as a community. So we all accept that, but sometimes we're very sheepish and apologetic, or we feel guilt-ridden, rather than saying, I'm an 18-year-old girl, and what's appropriate for an 18-year-old girl? When I'm 30 years old, there'll be a different level of achievement that's appropriate. When I'm 40, it'll be a different level. When I'm 50, as a lechatchila. That's the way, by reaching too far, sometimes it becomes incompatible and it doesn't fit, doesn't sync properly. And that can create divided identity. That's where Rav Amital drew from this Parsha of Shlach. Let me read some of the examples he applied. He quoted Rav Yoel Ben Nun, who was once discussing, interestingly enough, it's not on your source sheets, I'm just quoting it from the Sikha, was once discussing rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash. I just was involved in a panel discussion about this. Should we build the Beis HaMikdash, Harabayit? And Rav Yoel said as follows, he hoped that we would be worthy of it. The rabbi replied, galled somewhat, worthy? But it's a mitzvah. You see that dynamic I'm playing? It's a mitzvah, it's an ideal, but maybe it's only a mitzvah we can achieve when we're worthy of it, and there are the other areas we have to refurbish before we can be worthy of attaining that mitzvah, as David HaMelech was not yet worthy, maybe not through personal guilt, just he was at a different stage of history. He was conquering the land, he was battling legitimate wars, and he wasn't yet at the point of tranquility and national security to warrant that mitzvah being executed on his behalf, even though he longed for it. So what Rav Amital, this is Rav Amital commenting on that encounter, what that rabbi failed to understand, Rav Amital now is commenting, they want us to be on a certain level in order to merit performing a mitzvah. If he has yet to achieve that level, then performance of the mitzvah is not worthwhile and may even be detrimental. And now Rav Amital gave more of a historical context. So I tell you all so often how Rav Amital, someone asked last week about Rav Amital, how he had the sense of history, and he took us back to different points in history, not through ideas, but through people. He took us through the journey of ideas, what 17th century thinkers, and Rav Amital just told the stories about what 18th and 19th century rabbanim talked about, their discourse. In 19th century Poland, there was a debate amongst religious Zionist leaders. Rav Shmuel Mulliver wanted to reestablish the Beis HaMikdash, but Rav Yeshaya Yeshua of Kutna, another famous Rav, told him that just building it would not help the public. Am Yisrael, in its present state, would not come to offer sacrifices. What it mean to build a Beis HaMikdash if we're not yet prepared to offer korbanos? Rav Mulliver answered, this would not matter. Individuals could offer korbanos on behalf of the entire people, thereby restoring the practice to its former glory. The Klei Chemda, happened to be Rav Meir Don Plotsky of Ostrava, cites the discussion and concludes that Rav Mulliver did not understand Rabbi Yeshua's reply. What Rabbi Yeshua was trying to say was that if Am Yisrael is not on the level of wanting to bring sacrifices, then having a Beis HaMikdash wouldn't help. The technical act of offering a korban is not going to benefit anyone if they're not on the level. So what, that they'll be tzaddikim, they'll offer korbanos. If I'm not at the level I want to bring a korban, then even if you bring a korban for me, it doesn't represent my level, it doesn't represent my interest. If I want to bring a korban, I can't make it that day, and I point a shliach, so I'm in sync, mentally. I'm in sync with the issue of a korban, I just can't execute it. But if I'm completely disinterested in korbanos, what will it help that a few tzaddikim enter the Beis HaMikdash and offer a korban?
You see that? I think often in the Nevi, when they do the physical act,
right. Well, it's even worse, to be honest. Not right. Just a physical act, it's moral corruption.
Right.
It's hypocrisy. This is not hypocrisy, this is just disproportion between interest and ceremony. And to back it up, Rav Amital quoted Rav Kook. And Rav Kook, in one of his letters, he wrote a lot of letters. There's the Svarim he wrote, the letters, the articles he wrote in various newspapers. He's responding to, I forget what, but it's in letter 20, and I reproduced it for you here. He says as follows. Let's just read it as much as we can. Hinei Bilashoni, paragraph 2. This is an excerpt. Lo ninsam makom l'sheila shermarti, v'pnei shehu b'yameinu davar she'ino nishma. He's actually quoting a Gemara in Yevamos. The Gemara in Yevamos that I quoted on the bottom says that just like there's a mitzvah to rebuke someone, there's also a mitzvah not to rebuke someone if they won't listen. So there's a halacha category of a message that people aren't yet prepared to hear. And that's already recognized and acknowledged by halacha. That person isn't ready to hear that message, then it's considered davar she'eino nishma. That's a halachic status of something that shouldn't be said. So now, let's hear what he writes in the third paragraph of that letter. We have to reach, the national level has to reach a level of perfection. Al Kein Zo, si Atzas Hashem, line number 3. This is a very powerful statement. It's Hashem's will. Shehifli Eitza, he has deeper mysteries than we can penetrate. Sometimes we don't understand the ways of Hashem, but he is Hifli Eitza. His wisdom is Hifli, it's Pella. It's unknowable to us. Higdil Tushia, these are classic lines from Eov or from Yirmiyahu Lamed Beis, ideas and wisdom of Hashem that are beyond human apprehension and comprehension. Here's the thrust. Shekethi also hamir shekofos uma mismatim, the limitations of the national level, kein yihya nigra ka hayicholas. Hashem calibrates the capacity of Am Yisrael to achieve certain things based on their spiritual level. Said in simple English, if we're not yet compatible with that achievement, Hashem converts it into something elusive. Hashem will make something out of reach if we're not yet ready for it. So when something is out of reach of Am Yisrael, collectively it's because we're not yet ready for it. And sometimes, by way of extension, the effort isn't just to achieve it, but to try to improve ourselves in the absence of that achievement so that we merit the achievement. Achievement isn't just human effort. Achievement is creating a reality naturally where that achievement reflects where we are and where we're suitable and compatible for that achievement. It's a very, very powerful comment. And you understand where this is heading. We still live in a very secular nation, a secular government. So just these, I'm using a very, very dangerous term, but artificial leaps forward solely on the timeline of accomplishment. Let's build the base on Mikdash, let's hustle Mashiach, let's it, as opposed to let's have organic growth nationally and try to improve ourselves morally, religiously, spiritually, so that those achievements will match our national tone. This is a very, very powerful statement. Not many people would think this, so let's just finish with Crook so we'll get the flow. Umenias hayecholas hilanu le'eda al chefetz Hashem. Wow. Our inability to achieve it sometimes reflects the fact that Hashem doesn't want us to achieve it. I just want you to digest how provocative these comments are, so I'm reading it very slowly. What do you mean? It's an ideal. Hashem wants us to build a base on Mikdash. Hashem wants us to offer korbanos. We just are incapable. If we just pour more effort, we'll achieve it. No, Hashem doesn't want us to build a base on Mikdash yet because we're not spiritually at that level. It reflects Hashem's will that we're not yet at that stage. Therefore, He detaches it from human achievement. He distances it. And Hashem's disinterest, a lack of will, there are different manifestations. And how do you know that Hashem doesn't want it? So Rav Kook's telling you, sometimes lifamim minias masis, sometimes it's practical. Hashem distances it from human achievement. Sometimes practically, politically, I mean, let's just map it without coming to any conclusions. Just let's map it. Does Hashem want us to have uncontested sovereignty on this land? The simple approach is that this is just an exercise. I'm just taking you through these steps to show you how it changes your thinking. I'm not telling you what I believe or what the conclusion is in our conclusions. So I would say, of course he does, and if we just pour more effort into settling and diplomacy and why not? It seems like Hashem wants this. Kivazara chateinis aretz hazos. It applies to everyone. But the counterclaim would be, if we're meeting such stiff opposition, then we should turn inward and improve Torah and improve spirituality and improve the type of society we're building and democracy. So it's a game changer. Personally, and a game changer nationally. And sometimes the limitation is not just political or practical, but sometimes it's spiritual. If people aren't listening to your message, it's because work on things they're willing to listen to. It's a built-in myth. That's something they're not listening to, so work on issues such as morality, democracy, social welfare. They are interested. I mean, a major, major shift in national religious history. A lot of people looking back at the last 50 years, because it's clear that the first 20 years of the State of Israel were pre-state years. They had a state, but it was fledgling. The real core of Israeli history has been from 67 to... That's really where some of the great events have taken shape. A lot of people are looking back retrospectively, and it's clear that from 75 till, let's say, 95 or 2005, it's clear that the national religious movement became, some would say focused, some would say obsessed, choose your word, on land at the cost of people. So the parties carrying the flag of social welfare and social justice and rights of handicap became the left-wing parties, because we're focused on land, and if we just conquer more land, and that's an imbalance that I think is reflected, because at some point, if we're not granted that uncontested sovereignty, we don't back down, but we redistribute our efforts and our resources. Okay, let's just finish. It says, Uchishiyeshna, after footnote 14, Menios Ke'elu, this is Hashem's will. So it's not just human failure. It may be a sign from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that the timing isn't right. Okay, so digest that for a moment before we get to the really big topic and how to relate to secular Jews. But it really is a whole different model of thinking on both levels, both personally as well as nationally. And it probably, the next time someone stops you on the street and says, oh, you lived in Migdalos for a year. You went for a Tarek and Shir. You heard a lot about Rav Amital. They say he was a humanist. What does that mean? Oh, humanist. I can tell you what he said about Slichos. This is probably one of his humanist moments. To accept human limitations, not as failures, but as just what's right at that moment, let's say on a personal level. You are aspiring to all sorts of achievements in life and you never give up those aspirations. What?
The sentence that you just like accepting
human limitations. But there may be levels that you're just currently at that are more reflective of an organic and holistic growth in Avodas Hashem for the moment, not to give up your aspirations. And I keep returning you to that dichotomy between Avodas Hashem and Rav Amital, because I don't think Rav Aaron would have ever spoken that way. He was that person. He's very accepting and embracing, but his voice was so demanding and challenging and aspirational. And achieve and step that extra hour and finish the next masechta and push yourself beyond your limits and push and push and push and grow and grow and grow and climb and climb and climb. And then Rav Amital is telling us, it's all right, understand where you are right now. Like, how do you mold those two voices? And somehow it worked. Because those two voices were our two powerful, powerful voices. If you don't have aspirations in life, in area, in any area, and certainly in religion, then you're stagnant and complacent and decayed. Morally or religious, you always have to be improving, and how can you find some new area of religious life and halachic improvement? And you always want to be growing and challenging yourself to higher ground. Don't be complacent, don't be self-satisfied. But you also have to accept certain realities and limitations, and where you draw that midpoint is going to very much determine your religious equilibrium. Some people are so driven and so driven and so driven, and when they ultimately fail, it can create a lot of disassociative guilt. And some people are so complacent and so relaxed and so nonchalant about their religious growth that it just becomes very sterile and fossilized. And how can you create that balance between the two and try to achieve but accept limitations in your achievement? And that's a very, very important. That could be your final gift for walking out of Migdal HaOz, your souvenir. You have that inner compass, and you're always twisting it, sometimes towards aspirations, sometimes towards acceptance and acknowledgement. But it's right at that midpoint, rather than wild swings. I think you'll have a healthy religious life. Yes, I'm sorry, as soon as you get the full brunt of Rav Kook. Yes.
You kind of just said the end, but I just feel like it's a dangerous game to play to say that, like, because we can't achieve something, that's like God saying that's our limitation. And like, I remember SD and Orr had like an argument about this before Yom Kippur, about, or maybe it was Rosh Hashanah, I'm not sure the difference like between the Ramban Tzusa.
You girls even remember Rosh Hashanah? Like, a century ago.
The Ramban Tzusa of Kiva and Rav Tzadok. And and they had this whole argument, right? And remember, in
yeah.
Panel?
It was memorable.
It was.
It was really memorable. Yeah.
And it was like, because Orr was saying, no, like Rav Tzadok says, Tshuva is like accepting your limitations, and Esti was like, no, like the Rambam says, like it's like pushing yourself and improving yourself. And I guess I kind of agreed with Esti, because it is a dangerous thing to say, like, okay, we can't achieve it, so therefore we're not supposed to achieve it.
Okay, so let's just frame your question with two answers. Number one can claim that there are different points in your life in which one voice should dominate the other voice. It's the voices in our head. So it's important to have voices in your head and to be able to...
Voices.
Yeah, they have different voices, and sometimes in your life one voice is more appropriate, sometimes in your life another voice is more appropriate. So there's no question that, not just because she's my boss, because she isn't, but I agree with Esti about Tshuva. I think Tshuva does create a tilt, a legitimate tilt towards guilt, pushing yourself, frustration, mortification. And you listen to any one of my dozens of shiurim, and you'll hear those voices very, very powerful in my comments. Although there were some moments where Rav Amital brought us back to reality, even within the tshuva process. The second comment was basically the first comment, is the greatest errors in life is when you take one position in Judaism or in Chazal and cast it as the exclusive one. So my recommendation, without having been at that panel conversation, was to take Esti and Orr and put them together in some puzzle and find the balance between them. You know, in as much as, let's say, those who are reflective of Esti, of her father, let's say, or of Rav Amital, so that's why I'm trying to give you this composite. But it's generally true in terms of religion to be able to have those composite voices in your head, in that composite picture, and not to choose one. That can lead to very radical and very fleeting Avodas Hashem. Okay, so let's stop on the recording, because that was just a